Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, happy Monday, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and we got some fascinating subject matter to talk about today. A guest that has a love of history and the unusual. We're going to be talking about unearthing ancient America, the lost sagas of conquerors, castaways, and a few scoundrels thrown in. My guest today is Frank Joseph. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
Now, you are an editor-in-chief of a magazine that's titled Ancient American, and you started this magazine in 1993. You've done 20 books, and they've been published in countries throughout the world. You have one that is Discovering the Mysteries of Ancient America, and then you have Opening the Art of the Covenant. Now, I'm intrigued with the fact that this is such a fascination for you. Running a magazine is arduous. What made you decide you were going to take on this challenge, and why Ancient America?
The answer to that is that we wanted to tell the truth, my publisher, Wayne May, and myself. And the truth about the prehistory of our continent has been deliberately suppressed for well over 100 years, going on 150 years. And we had had enough of that, especially the way that it's misrepresented in our educational system.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the things that are discussed in our magazine have actually been very well known in academic circles, but have never been brought to the attention of ordinary people like myself. And I thought that it was time for our historic legacy to be made public.
Now, your magazine obviously has been quite successful. Here we are in 2008, so you've got quite a good run with your magazine. With doing your research, what have you found to be the greatest challenge relative to the representation of this information and being able to communicate it clearly and succinctly to those that maybe are doubting Thomas's?
Well, the greatest challenge, I think, is what the educators of all stripes are encountering these days, and that's a declining literacy rate in America, unfortunately, and a sort of a dumbing down of the culture that's been going on for far too long. So I would say our greatest challenge is to stir interest in our fellow Americans, and it's a shame because this is their story. This is not just the story of Indians or Native Americans, although they play a major important role in all this. It's the story of America being a melting pot long before Columbus ever set sail. Matter of fact, long before even modern Spain came into existence.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, a heritage which is extremely interesting. It shows our roots, and most importantly, it holds up certain parallels to our own times. Were these civilizations in the past were successful, where they went wrong, and why they're no longer around? What happened? We know for a fact that there were four major civilizations that were here on the North American continent before the United States was ever founded. Well, what happened to these civilizations? Why did they rise and fall? And that really is the task that we have undertaken. These four major civilizations were just really surrounded by numerous others, dozens of other cultures, smaller ones, that couldn't get a foothold or for one reason or another decided not to get a foothold. Some of them, as the book says, were just castaways,
mm-hmm.
and others were scoundrels, to be sure. But the main scoundrels in our book are the modern archaeologists who are not willing to let this information be popularized as they sort of denigrate the idea.
Well, paradigms are a funny thing to have to get through. It's so difficult sometimes to even get particular institutions, I don't care what generation you belong to be open and receptive. And those established areas of thought, once they're ingrained, it's very difficult to go into that arena. So you do have to be outside the box. You do have to be able to have that freedom of communication. And fortunately, in today's world, we do have the Internet where there is that communication. And your book is absolutely fascinating. I think that any kid in school would just absolutely love this, and teachers would just have a fabulous time with it. Let's start off with one of the very first stories in your book, and it's about an ancient Egyptian statuette that was found in Illinois. Now, for me, this is not uncomfortable to deal with at all, because archaeologically throughout the globe, we are finding that peoples were... We had a global marketplace hundreds of thousands of years ago, as far as I'm concerned. And things have come and gone, and been here, and not been here, and evolution. We've gone into dark ages, we come into golden ages, and it just seems to be a cycle that humanity put itself through. But man's always been an adventurer, always, man and woman both. And in the United States, to find these items, tell us about this particular statuette that was found in Illinois, and that it was a dynastic Egyptian statue. Give us some details.
Well, it's really very refreshing to hear your enlightened views on this subject, and I don't have to fight with you over the fact that, yes, there were people here before Columbus. The Egyptian statuette that was found in a town called Libertyville, Illinois, it's about 40 miles outside of Chicago, north-northwest of Chicago, was found about 60 years ago. And it was found inside an Indian mound. Unfortunately, it was not found by a credible, a certified archaeologist, and therefore, because it wasn't found by them, they regard it as useless, which is really tragic. The object itself is beautifully made. It's not something that was a fugitive from some world's fair or something. It's beyond, really, even some of the... If you go to Egypt today and you buy things like this in the markets over there, they, of course, reproductions all over it. None of them are as good as this one that's found in Libertyville. I can tell you, I've been over to Egypt several times, and they have some nice reproductions, but nothing as nice as this. I don't think that, and others who have seen this object, and we photograph it and put it in the in our book, they can't imagine that this thing was made today. What it is briefly, it's an Anushapti. Anushapti is a kind of a small statuette that was buried in the tombs with royalty, top royalty usually. And the idea was that the Ushapti represented symbolically a kind of a helpful spirit that was conjured into the tomb so that when the deceased went to the next world, he or she had their servants with them. And these were, it was a kind of a spirit that was of a helpful nature. The interesting thing about this little statuette, this Ushapti that was found in Libertyville, Illinois, is that a close examination of it really quite easily dates its origins, which is right around 600 B.C., about 600 years before Christ. And that's very interesting because at that time there was a pharaoh whose name was Necho, and Necho launched the first circumnavigation of Africa. It took place around 600 B.C., in the Dark Ages that followed, this great achievement was forgotten, and it was up to Renaissance sailors to repeat that achievement without knowing that it had already been done long before. So here we have a statuette from a time in which major navigational explorations were taking place. So it's conceivable, admittedly, this is a coincidental conclusion, but it nonetheless fits the physical evidence to show that someone... perhaps was blown off course, or it was part of the expedition that circumnavigated Africa and arrived perhaps not in Illinois, perhaps along the eastern shore of North America, but that this Ushapti was used as a trade good by Native Americans, and that's how it wound up inside a Native American and Indian mound. That mound itself was dated to about 800 years ago, long after this object was made, but it was regarded as a kind of a treasure and passed on. It's only one small indication of the tremendous impact that the ancient Egyptians made on the New World, but it's certainly one of the most beautiful and represents hard evidence that needs to be studied further.
You'd have a mention in your book about Dr. Gunnar Thompson, and there is apparently a publication, The American Discovery, The Real Story, that he put together that said that Egyptian voyages to America, that isn't something that's far-fetched. This is something that really is very plausible because of the tremendous amount of trade that they did. Go into that a little bit.
Well, one of the great trade items that they engaged in was cocaine.
That's interesting.
Yes. About 15 years ago, when there was a restoration project in place in the Cairo Museum, there were a number of Egyptian mummies which were being restored. They were in bad shape. And it was noticed amongst these mummies, and these were dynastic Egyptian mummies. They were not bodies that had existed after the fall of Egyptian civilization. These mummies went back well over 1,000 years before Christ. And inside these mummies were found unmistakable traces of cocaine. And this was not just something that somebody theorized. The head of antiquities in Egypt was called in, and they certified that, yes, there are traces of cocaine and other tobacco in these Egyptian mummies. Now, cocaine and tobacco were never raised in all of Africa, certainly not in the Nile Valley. The traces that were made in the cocaine established that they came from Peru and Bolivia. There was so much of it that it's common to find in Egyptian mummies cocaine.
Amazing.
The uses for cocaine by the ancients was completely different than the criminal use of it today. Cocaine was used apparently in the embalming process somehow. The Egyptians mastered embalming. They had secrets that have not been unlocked to this day. And also, cocaine was used under the administration, the careful administration of the high priests, to achieve altered states of consciousness during spiritual exercises.
Mm-hmm.
Just as the ancients used the laurel wreath, the Pythia in ancient Greece would chew the laurel wreath to get a minor narcotic effect that would assist her in getting that altered state of consciousness. So it was extremely important for the Egyptians, for their embalming processes, and also for their religious, their spiritual purposes, to obtain this item. And they could have only obtained it from Bolivia and Peru. Now, this has been known since the early 1990s, and yet has not filtered at all into the public consciousness because there are vested interests, literally vested interests, in maintaining the fiction that no one was here before Columbus from overseas. And this is physical evidence that is just in abundance.
Amazing. Now, there's another link that I found fascinating about this relating to the Egyptian connection regarding the early period of America, and that is that there's traces of the Egyptian language that are noted in the Native American language. Go into that a little bit.
Well, it's amazing. It is taught in the schools to this day that the Native Americans had no written language before the modern Europeans arrived. That is completely incorrect. There were several written languages, not many, but there were several that were used, one by the Cherokee, for example. It's mm-hmm. well documented. But the one that I'm referring to, the one that you're sitting me on to, was the Mi'kmaqs. The Mi'kmaqs still exist. They're a very small tribe numerically. They inhabit the Maine, Labrador, that area. And they had, and still have, a written language on birch bark. And the written language was examined, is not even known to most archaeologists, but it was examined and studied in great detail by a man by the name of Professor Dr. Barry Fell, who was a great epigrapher. In other words, he was an investigator of written languages and compared different written languages, and was able to show numerous cognates, in other words, similar words or words that were exactly the same, between the written language of the Mi'kmaqs and ancient Herodic Egyptian. And in his book, America B.C., he photographically shows comparison between Egyptian dynastic Herodic written language and hieroglyphs and the written language of the Mi'kmaqs, and there are numerous comparisons far beyond the possibility of any possible coincidences involved. He also shows that some of these same words were used. One of these symbols, for example, represents a wavy line, and this represented the sea. Well, that's rather obvious. But the thing about that was interesting about this hieroglyph that both the Mi'kmaqs and the ancient Egyptians had for the sea, this wavy line, is that it was pronounced exactly the same, N. And there are numerous other examples that parallel what the Mi'kmaqs themselves say, that they were visited in the past by the Eagle Man. And the Eagle Man brought with him across the sea, from across the Sunrise Sea, which was their name for the Atlantic Ocean, a bevy of sorcerers who had all this high magic, and they shared this magic, including the written language, with their ancestors, the Mi'kmaqs. Archaeologists know this story, but they dismiss it as just fable, even though they're confronted with the Mi'kmaq's own written language, which is paralleled very closely with ancient Egyptian.
Let's travel to Utah. You have the metallic tablets, of the Rockies. And there's a man, George Keller. He had a friend, Lone Eagle. You have a photograph of a metal plate that is covered with a pictorial script, and it was found in a cave in the Rocky Mountains of Utah. Tell us about this.
Well, this is one of our most baffling finds that we've discussed. We don't pretend to have the answers to all of these discoveries, and we offer very few theories. We try to present the evidence. And this particular essay that you're referring to is certainly one of the most baffling. Inside this cave in Utah were found many hundreds of beautifully crafted little stone boxes. And inside these boxes, they're only like about maybe 3.5 by 2.5 inches in dimension. They're made of limestone. Some are made of marble. They cannot be traced to any culture at all. There's no writing on them. However, they open up. The top opens up, and inside, amongst a kind of packing material, looks like straw, were found these metallic plates that are covered with a writing that resembles no writing known any place on Earth whatsoever. It resembles, believe it or not, a kind of electronic circuitry. I know that's going out on a limb to say that it is electronic circuitry, but it resembles that. And what's amazing about this discovery is that, number one, it was found under conditions, as we describe in the book, that are far beyond the possibility of having created as a modern fraud. Nobody made any money from it. Nobody tried to become famous or anything like that. And the other thing is that they are found in great abundance, perhaps 1,000 or more.
Oh,
of these stone boxes have been recovered. And that means that there are many thousands, several thousands, of these metallic plates, which nobody can read, nobody can identify with any culture whatsoever. And the writing themselves, if it is writing, has been embossed, has been stamped into the metal plates. They're not written or painted on. It represents a technology which seems very modern and yet is completely inscrutable. We put this in the book as really one example of several that are like this in America that indicate a high culture, who knows from where, that contributed to the early prehistory of our continent.
And with these plates, there were also some mummies that were found that were covered with a straw-like cloth.
That's right. The mummies themselves no longer exist. Naturally, we're in a very fragile condition, and when they were found, the cave itself was hermetically sealed. Whether that was accidentally or on purpose, we don't know. The mummies themselves, however, some were photographed. We've never been able to track those photographs down. But the mummies did definitely exist. There were witnesses who signed sworn affidavits that they existed. The mummies themselves were described as Caucasian, but that might be an inaccuracy because they decayed very shortly thereafter. However, they were of very large stature. And that's rather troubling.
Bimini.
Who these people were, where they came from, nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
But these plates, which exist, appear to be very authentic. If they're part of a hoax, it was an extremely elaborate one, done for no purpose, apparently, because nobody's made a dime off of it, or nobody became famous over it. So
mm-hmm.
it's
pretty much been quiet. There's not been any big fanfare over it at all, because there is truthfully a lot. And, well, he kept the secret, George did, for a long time. Before he passed away, he wanted to be sure that people knew about it. And you had gotten to know George, and it just worked out that way. I just think this stuff is so interesting. For those of you just tuning in, we're talking with Frank Joseph. The book is Unearthing Ancient America, and these are documented items regarding various places in the United States that artifacts have been found, Roman artifacts that you would never expect to be found. And let's go to Bimini, because this is an area, there's the Bimini Road. It's a 1,200-foot-long stone structure, 19 feet beneath the surface of the Atlantic Ocean. It's just a short distance off of Miami. It was discovered in 1968, and you've got some phenomenal photography here. Now, of course, the likelihood of being able to drain the area is, you know, not going to happen, because obviously there were volcanic eruptions and things like this that caused a big shake-up, you know, who knows when. But tell us about what you know regarding Bimini Road. What's the latest information on this? Because this has created controversy for years.
It has. Well, you've summarized it quite well. The structure, as you say, was found in 1968, and since then there's been a marvelous organization headed by Dr. William Donato. He is a certified archaeologist, so there are some mainstream people that have come over to these problems, not many, and he runs an organization appropriately called the Atlantis Organization.
Mm-hmm.
And he has sunk, if you don't mind the metaphor, quite a lot of his own personal fortune into investigating this specific island and structure. The latest to be found on the Bimini Road is a series of tests, geologic tests, that were conducted on the stones, and they completely demolish the arguments of critics who say, oh, it's just a natural collection of beach rock that formed over the course of years. Well, some of the rocks that have now been tested are of granite that came from Georgia. Some of the stones apparently were brought from great distances to build what appears to be the remains of, the ruins of, a harbor facility.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And what we're looking at, the so-called Bimini Road, is not a road at all. Some people thought that it might have been a road and that over time sea levels buried it. It's not at all. It's a foundation. It appears to be the foundation of a quay or a harbor facility of some kind. And one reason why it reveals itself as such is because it terminates in a J configuration. Now, when you find structures like this in the Mediterranean, archaeologists have no problem identifying them as Bronze Age harbor facilities, because that was the style back in the Bronze Age, which was between 3000 BC and 1200 BC. In other words, beginning about 5,000 years ago, This was a typical Bronze Age harbor. Even its length compares exactly with harbors that are found off of Israel and Greece and Crete. So here we're seeing the exact same thing, not 50 miles east of Miami, 19 feet below the surface. I've had the privilege of diving on that site several times. I've investigated it. And all one has to do is really see the beach rock that does exist on the east side of Bimini. There is beach rock, and from a distance it looks, oh, this looks man-made. But when you go up closer to it, you can see that it's very irregular. It looks like a set of bad teeth, that one stone overlaps the other and so on. But when you see the so-called Bimini Road, which is really referred to now more correctly as the Bimini Wall, there is no overlapping, and the stones are not these flat, broken things, but they're all like pillow-shaped, again, which piled one on top of the other, some of them. Again, completely parallels the Bronze Age harbors that are found in the Mediterranean. So we have, I think, clear, unmistakable evidence that the Bimini Road or Bimini Wall is the remains of a Bronze Age harbor. The people came from the Near East or from Western Europe and created this harbor off the coast of Bimini for a very specific reason. Because the northern end of Bimini, right where this structure is found, is in the middle of a current which goes straight across from Gibraltar and empties out into the Gulf of Mexico. Anybody that catches this current, say if you're on a sailing ship, can use the same current to go back to the old world, because it, from Bimini, it goes up along the east coast of North America and then around Maine, makes a right angle turn directly east and takes you back to Western Europe. So this would be the last possible landfall for a freighter that was bringing some precious goods from North America back to Europe. And you mentioned before international trade. The trade here involved appears to have been copper, and that Bimini was part of the massive copper trade, which was definitely international, and the copper trade was responsible for the Bronze Age that we're talking about. Without high-grade copper, you can't make bronze, and the best high-grade copper in the world came from the Upper Peninsula of North America, the Great Lakes region, and Bimini was part of that. Bimini was the focal point for the freighters that were able to ship this massive copper cargoes back towards Western Europe and the Near East.
Well, I know our time is getting a little bit short here, Frank, but I would love for you to talk about the City of the Dead that Indians of Wisconsin told the early settlers in the early 19th century that it was in their sacred lake. Tell us about that City of the Dead.
This is another example of underwater archaeology. This is not in the ocean. There's a small lake between Milwaukee and Madison in southern Wisconsin, known as Rock Lake. And when the first pioneers crossed in the 1820s from the Milwaukee area towards Madison, they came across this tamarack forest enshrouded lake, and were told by the Native Americans that there was a City of the Dead, rock teepees at the bottom of this lake. And it wasn't until the following century, exactly the year 1900, that the first of these structures were found during a period of prolonged drought. And since then, the structures have sort of vanished and reappeared again, according to the vagaries of the lake. But now, another organization called the Rock Lake Research Society, that was founded about 9 or 10 years ago, has made wonderful documentation and has revealed excellent photographs of what appear to be stone pyramids, several styles of stone pyramids at the bottom of this small lake, which is about 3 miles from north to south, 1 3/4 miles east to west, deepest point 90 feet, an average depth of 60 to 40 feet. And these structures, some of them resemble elongated tents about 100 feet long. Others resemble much smaller structures, like ice cream cones turned upside down. They are, we presume, sundials. And others look like little miniature volcanoes. We know what those are. The Native Americans tell us they're Pocasawa pits. They are family crypts or vaults in which the deceased are buried in the walls of this structure, and the crater-like formation of the top was used by the surviving family members to communicate with the deceased and to be part of a vision quest. So it's a fascinating underwater discovery, which some archaeologists are certified, mainstream archaeologists, like Professor James Shears, who we dedicate the book to, have said, yes, this is real, it's authentic, we're seeing it. And other archaeologists just shun it as being so much of a diver's joke and are not interested in that sort of a thing.
Well, I'll tell you what. Your book, Unearthing Ancient America, is absolutely intriguing. And for those of you that want to have material that's not, it's not woo-woo, this is fact. There's so much that we don't know because, well, how are you going to know unless somebody's out there checking things out? There's a lot more about this country of ours and about the world that we live in that we are just beginning, because of technology, just beginning to be able to really document and see. So this is great stuff. Unearthing Ancient America. Frank Joseph is my guest. Frank, what is your website where people can find out more about your magazine and other things?
Well, they can do that easily. It's www.ancientamerican, all one word lowercase, .com.
AncientAmerican.com. Well, this has been just fascinating. Your book is mesmerizing because there's so much wonderful information that people, if they have curiosity, they can explore. Unearthing Ancient America, Frank Joseph has been my guest. Go to his website, ancientamerican.com. This is Donna Sebo. Thanks again, Frank. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's T-TAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and those telephone lines are now open. So if you'd like to give me a buzz so we can chat, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Here are the phone numbers to call in to. 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. We also have a direct line of 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. Well, first I want to thank those of you who have come to the class and the informational meeting we had on glyconutrients and nutrition and physical wellness, and we shared TTAP information with the people. It was just dynamic, absolutely wonderful. And we had a wonderful speaker. His name was Ron Frentz, and he gave us a lot of good nutritional information, and it's always a joy to be able to share knowledge with anyone, and it was a pleasure having such a wonderful, wonderful turnout for the meeting, and as others come up, we'll be sure to let you know about that. So anyway, thanks again to all of you that participated, to our speaker that was there, Ron, and to everybody who participated and contributed. It was just an absolutely incredibly fabulous experience. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to show you how it's done on the show. Let's go to our first caller for the day, first name or initial, and where are you calling in from, please?
Hello?
Hi, dear. What's your first name or initial?
Hi. My name is Veronica, and I'm calling from Pasadena, California.
From Pasadena. Oh, boy. That's such a pretty area.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely gorgeous down there. Okay, Veronica, let's get down to business with you. The first thing I'm looking at is take a deep breath, hon. Don't get so stressed and so anxious. I am seeing you feeling as if someone or something has put you into slow motion, and you're just wanting to make things move so much more quickly than they are at this time. Be grateful for that, because there are a lot of external situations related to people that you know, to your job environment, to so many things that you have absolutely no control over. And if you were going, 10,000 miles an hour ahead with blinders on, you wouldn't really be able to see very much. It's sort of like a racehorse. If you don't have a good jockey on your back, you could be slamming into walls, doing all kinds of things. So you don't want to do that. Even
okay.
though you feel so impatient, you feel like you should be able to do things a lot more rapidly. It's happening at its own rhythm, within its own rhythm, at its own tempo, and you want to be able to keep that consistency so that you don't have unnecessary stumbling or bungling. Also, I want you to take care of some clutter that's in your space. And I'm seeing an image, it's like a cartoon, where you're feeling oppressed, as if there's a whole bunch of stuff all around you, and you're afraid if you move, everything's going to come toppling down. Well, you don't need to be that concerned, because I don't think things are going to fall in on top of you. But I think being discerning and being able to put things into proper order so that you don't have this feeling of almost being overwhelmed, you don't want to have that feeling. You want to discern the realities of what you're dealing with and then take care of them one at a time. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Good. Now, the next thing I want you to do is take it easy on yourself because you've had a wacky time with what I'd call food patterns. And you've had something of an irregular schedule, and you go, what's the matter with me? The harder I try to make some shifts and changes, it's just not happening. You've been under a lot of stress. So instead of putting the cart in front of the horse, why don't you just sort of ease up here, recognize what you have no control over, and then little by little, I think you're going to be able to make the changes that you want to make for yourself, for your own wellness, and do it in a balanced way. Economically, it's going to be a little tight for you, dear, but it's not going to be unmanageable. You're going to be able to work with this. And one of the things I'd like to see you do is to start becoming educated about investing, because there's a number of different arenas that you could become interested in. And just with little bits of money, you could start seeing a compounding of your dollars that would make you quite happy in about 10, 15 years.
Okay.
So start now. You don't have to have $500,000 to begin investing. You can start with 10 if necessary.
Okay.
What would you like to ask me about?
Well, I talked to you early this year, and you helped me. You did say I was going to get a different job, and I did. And I just wanted to see if you see anyone as far as relationships coming in for me now.
Well, it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for marriage, I'm not seeing marriage immediately, no. I think that you are still working on your own life and your own space, and you have some fears regarding relationships. And I use the plural for a reason. There is a guilt that you have sometimes that is totally not necessary about being interested in dating more than one person at a time and not having what I'd call a real sincere commitment with someone. You don't have to, dear. It's okay for you to, if you wanted to date 20 different guys, it's perfectly all right. It doesn't mean like you're an infamous woman. It just means that you have an interest in a number of different people, and that's all right. The level that you want to take a relationship to is, again, your choice. And I'd say don't try to make anything real serious at this time. Learn how to enjoy who you are and the development of who you are that is progressing in its own way, and just be at peace with yourself. There is going to be a marriage. You are going to be getting married, but it could be in about 3 years. Okay. And I don't want you to have an attitude of, oh, that's just terrible. I don't want you to get stuck with the typical dispositioning that so many women and men end up with. Because what you'll do is lock yourself into a paradigm, and you'll think that there's no hope or no options for you, when really there are. But you have not really been ready for what I call that commitment. And in truth, you haven't met that person that I think would be a very good partner for you.
Right.
I'm looking at a man that appears to be about 2 years older, two, maybe three, and he has gone through some pretty rough roads. In fact, he is going through, at this very time, as I'm speaking with you, a really rocky relationship with someone. And part of his challenge has been growing up about his attitudes regarding women. And so he's no more ready for what I'd call a real relationship, which he will be at the time that the two of you meet, than a man on the moon. So you both are growing, and when the time is right, you're both going to meet, and you're going to harmonize, and you're going to be amazed at the parallels that will be in your life patterning. The stuff he will have gone through, when you were going through certain things, and you're both going to talk about this, you're going to say, this is unbelievable. In a million years, what are the odds of two people going through such parallels occurring? And you'll realize that both of you had to grow up to be able to evolve into the type of people that when you do meet, you will have a good, good marriage. It'll be the right kind of a relationship.
Okay.
Does that help you?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. And for heaven's sake, have a good time when you're dating.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome, Veronica. This is Donna Sebo. Hey, if you want to give me a call, just like Veronica did, it's real simple. 877-8765-227. That's 877-8765-227. Canadians, it's 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. And then a direct line of 530-876-3222. 530-876-3222. Those numbers are available and open, and give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. I came across a quote that I wanted to share with you. It's by Greg Braden. I really like this. Every second we choose to nourish ourselves in a way that supports or depletes our lives, and to think and speak about other people in a way that is honoring or dishonoring. What choice are you going to make today? Now, that's a very significant question. So often, it is easy to get into the criticizing mode. So easy, it's just unbelievable. And then the next thing you know, your conversation, your thoughts are going to go into all kinds of directions, none of which are really going to be healthy and positive. Now, I'm not Pollyannish. I'm not of the disposition of, you know, if something is not really positive, it's unhealthy or whatever, you need to be honest about that. But talk about the facts to the best of your knowledge. But there's another thing that I have had to so frequently remind myself about, and that is, until you know everything that's going on, your assumptions are just that. They can be assumptions. And many times people are so private about what's going on in their lives that you may think that they're being snobs, or they are just totally self-serving, or they just don't want to be friendly. I mean, there's all kinds of things that we'll make assumptions about. And we may not be aware that maybe a person is going through so much pain that they can hardly breathe. And that expression on their face is the only one that they know how to exhibit, and they're not even aware of the expression on their face. Or when someone's in grief, or when someone's terrified, or they're confused. Lots of times we have such masks on ourselves that we don't want other people to know what's going on in our lives. So it's very easy for us to criticize, and that's why it's good to ask questions, to be open, and to be communicative. It is not always easy to do, but boy, it sure can make you aware of things that otherwise you wouldn't have a clue about. So choose to nourish yourself in a way that supports your life, not where it depletes it. If you're watching stuff on television that is junk, you got the channel selector in your hand. Stop complaining. Turn the television off if you don't like anything that's on. But keep on moving on. We've got a lot of choices in life. Which one are you going to choose? And when we're talking about people, how do you want to talk about them? If you have the facts, fine. If you honestly don't know, then maybe try to find out. Find out what you need to know. I have made so many wrong assumptions in my life at various times that it took, you know, finally I got the drift. And I went, whoa, I had this concept and this idea. It's just what we do as people. So make a choice. It's yours. This is Donna Siebel. We're going to take a break. We're coming right back. I'll have some suggestions for you, some green suggestions. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown-red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Siebel accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Siebel will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Siebel's website, www.delphiinternational.com. That 800 number again, 872-8852.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Siebel to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227. Canadians 888-815-9756 and 530-876-3222. Okay, here are the lineup. Here is the lineup of guests that we have for this week. Tomorrow we're going to be talking to E. Franklin Evans. This is a veteran, and his book is called Stand To, A Journey to Manhood. This is a very personal story about his journey into discovering who he was as a man and as an individual in serving his country. Then we're going to be talking about cancer caregiving A to Z. Patricia Swanson is going to be my guest. And unless you have had the experience, if it comes up where you need to take care of something or someone relative to cancer treatment, what do you do? Well, we're going to find out about a resource that you can utilize that will empower you, and maybe you'll be able to empower a friend or a neighbor. Then also, we're going to be talking about rock art. In the Mind's Eye, Essays Across an Animate World. Elizabeth Dodd is a researcher. She's traveled and checked out caves all across America. This is fascinating stuff. Again, we're going into the legacy of early America. And then health and disease symbology. This is something I've always found interesting. And Louise Hayes put out a book years and years ago regarding diseases and what they had in representation, what the symbology of that disease meant. Well, this is being taken to another level by Michael Schwartz. So we'll be talking with him on Friday. So a fascinating array of guests and, I think, subject matter. So I hope you'll tell your friends and you'll join us for all of this. Meanwhile, telephones are open, 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756, and 530-876-3222. Well, how can we improve what we're doing if we're in business? What are some of the steps that we can take? And if, as a consumer, what are some of the things that we can do to improve the environment? We are becoming so much more aware of this. And what I find so absolutely marvelous is that more and more people, including the very young, are becoming consciously attentive to making business operations more efficient and effective, and also the development of products. I've been reviewing material. These are some guests that are going to be coming. I'll have some guests coming up in the next month or so. And we are just going to be discussing this at length. It is just incredible, the fast-moving changes that are evolving. Well, let's talk about a few things for just a second. And these are real simple items. You know, before you get rid of a household item, you might find that something that is recyclable might be very usable for you in a way you would never have ever thought. And these are some tips that came from a magazine called The Green Guide. And this was put out by the National Geographic. Plastic bags. Use an empty tissue box as a dispenser for plastic shopping bags. Stuff them through the hole in the top and then pull them out as needed. And you can use the little square ones, the little square boxes, and just stuff them in there. Of course, there's all kinds of little things that you can buy, but heavens, why not use something that you would automatically be throwing out for recycle anyway? Then cans. You can discard an empty can and put that in your recycle. That's fine. Or you might want to become inventive and get your kids involved and maybe decorating an empty can, like your tuna, salmon, or other types of cans. And the little tuna cans can be very good for holding small items, like maybe items on a desk, loose things like paper clips, etc. Also, what you want to do when the can is empty of its contents, of course, you're going to want to clean it and remove its label. And then you want to sand any rough edges so you won't get cut. And you can also decorate it any way that you want. And if you apply water-resistant glue to the back of the paper or whatever you're going to use to decorate it, it's something that can be a very useful item, very practical item, as well as being attractive. Pantyhose. I don't know about the rest of you gals out there, but sometimes I can end up, don't ask me why. I know if you stick pantyhose in the freezer, they're not as likely to run. The freezing does something to the fibers that makes them stronger. But sometimes there are months when I can go through pantyhose, I don't know, it's just like, shoot, and then I have to pitch it. Well, I know that you can use pantyhose to wrap onions if you wanted to hang them in the garage during winter months. Well, that hasn't worked out in my, so I end up with all this pantyhose. Who would have thought you could take pantyhose, stockings, and put them around the edges of wrapping paper rolls and keep them from tearing? And I thought that was really a good idea. Now, what you do to do that is cut the legs off of the pantyhose, slide the legs over the wrapping paper rolls, leaving about 3 or 4 inches bare at the top so that you can see the design of the paper, and then just tie a knot in your pantyhose and to keep it from slipping down. Yogurt cups, you have kids. Use them as painter containers. They're great for watercolors and other art supplies. And the plastic lids just pop right on there. And of course, most of them come with those foil covers when you're getting ready to take the yogurt and eat it. But just discard that, wash that off, put that in the recycle. And you, those little cups make great containers for, again, artistic supplies. And cereal boxes, you can use them to store and display magazine and comic book collections. All you need to do is take a pencil and a ruler, draw diagonal lines on the wider sides of the cereal box, starting from the top corner and ending halfway down the box. Then you connect the two lines just drawn with a horizontal line across the slimmer side and cut off the entire top across the trace lines, and you've got something that is going to store your magazines instead of having to go out and buy it. Use those cereal boxes. And you can decorate those, too. The kids can decorate them if you have kids that can do that for you. So those are just some tips that I think you perhaps can use. And I know we're just about out of time. Don't forget, we've got a wonderful guest tomorrow, Stan Tu, A Journey to Manhood. So tell your friends. And remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Life is to be lived in this moment, being consciously mindful of how you live your life. Of what you say, what you do, makes you a very special and a very unique individual. enjoy life. It is a gift, and you're meant to be able to live it to the fullest. Talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here at bbsradio.com. Donna Siebel here. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.